Good evening. Tonight's reading can be found on page 1090 of the Church Bibles. That is John chapter 21, verses 1 to 14. Jesus and the miraculous catch of fish. Afterwards, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Galilee. It happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, also known as Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other disciples were together. "I'm going out to fish," Simon Peter told them, and they said, "We'll go with you." So they went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. He called out to them, "Friends, haven't you any fish?" "No," they answered. He said, "Throw your net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some." When they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It is the Lord." As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, "It is the Lord," he wrapped his outer garment round him, for he had taken it off, and jumped into the water. The other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from shore, about 100 meters. When they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish on it, and some bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish you have just caught." So Simon Peter climbed back into the boat and dragged the net ashore. It was full of large fish, 153, but even with so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." None of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came, took the bread and gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Good evening. My name's Andrew. I've preached in the church a few times before, so some of you might recognise me. I'm a regular at St Mary's, and it's my pleasure to be talking about tonight's passage, John 21, verses 1 to 14. So we've been looking, as Helen was saying earlier, at John's Gospel for a little while, going through the various chapters and picking out various themes as we go through. So we've been looking at serving, sending. Tonight is on fishing. And next week's is feeding. Apologies if this is making anybody hungry. But tonight we're focusing on John 21, 1 to 14, Jesus and the miraculous catch of fish, or perhaps that should be Jesus and the second miraculous catch of fish. We'll come back to that later on. As Helen was just saying, it's Easter weekend. Easter weekend was recently in our minds. Perhaps for some of us with children, it seems like more of a distant memory now, but certainly for some of us, it will still be recently in our minds. And it's with this sort of spirit and approach that I wanted to look at tonight's passage. So we should be looking at this passage in a sort of spirit of joy. This is a passage talking about the risen Jesus having come back, conquered the grave and come back, and is meeting his friends again. As I was preparing for tonight, doing a bit of reading, background reading, I discovered that the passage we're looking at tonight is a traditional one that's read in the weeks after Easter, and has been preached on many, many times, including people as notable as St. Augustine of Hippo and St. John Chrysostom, so two leading theologians in the first century after Jesus' death. So no pressure on me tonight. I'll see what I can do, but I'll try and do my best to compete. Before we get stuck into the passage, I thought it'd be a good idea to just draw out one little comparison, looking at John's gospel as a whole. So one of the things that I've previously preached on here at St. Mary's is the first encounter with the risen Jesus in Luke's gospel, which is with two of his followers on the road to Emmaus. And now I'm looking at the last encounter with Jesus in John's gospel. So there's a nice sort of bookending of Jesus's return after his death for me personally. But it's interesting thinking about those two gospel accounts and how they differ quite a lot. So I thought I'd just spend a minute thinking about that before we get stuck into the passage. So John's approach is very, very different from Luke's. Luke was probably a doctor. He was probably from a Gentile background. And he's been described in some modern literature as a sort of first century investigative journalist. So he didn't witness many of these things himself, but he went and spoke to the people who did, the eyewitnesses, and collated all of their testimonies and drew them together into one big account, which became the Gospel according to Luke. He was keen to emphasize the historical accuracy of his account, so he tied various events in Jesus' lifetime to historical events of the time, and he had a bit of an evidence-based approach. So he says himself, if you look at the start of Luke's Gospel, he says he carefully investigated everything from the beginning. John does not take this approach, and the reason is probably because he was there. He saw this stuff himself. He was one of Jesus' disciples. He didn't feel the need to evidence everything that happened because he knew it happened. He was there and saw it with his own eyes. He's even there in our passage tonight. If we look carefully, we can find him. It's not very obvious. He's a very modest writer and sort of makes an oblique reference to himself, but we'll spot him a bit later on. So John is less concerned with proof. What does he focus on then? John focuses on Jesus' divinity, in particular his miracles, which he calls Jesus' signs. And tonight's passage is about one of those signs. So we're going to focus on that. John's gospel is almost in a completely different category to all of the others. The first three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are known as the synoptic gospels, which means seeing all together. So they offer a similar perspective, and they have similar content. John's is very different style. He records a number of events that are not seen in the other gospel accounts, and he refers very explicitly to Jesus being God, which is perhaps more only alluded to in the other gospel accounts. So John says right at the beginning of his gospel, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." And then he goes on to say, "The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us." So that's pretty explicit in saying that Jesus, who he's talking about, is God. What is John's goal if he's not trying to sort of evidentially prove the events of Jesus' life? Well, he's focusing on the miracles as a way of trying to convince us of the divinity of Jesus, so that we believe in him too, and we can then share in this offer of eternal life for the people who believe in Jesus. He actually handily, I've paraphrased him there, but he actually explicitly tells us that in the verse before the chapter that we're looking at tonight. So if you've got the Bible in front of you, just kind of rewind a little bit and look back at John 20, verse 31. He says, "But these are written," talking about the signs that Jesus performed, "these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and by believing that, you might have life in his name." So John's pretty clear about what he's trying to do here. What about tonight's passage? What can we take from that? So tonight's passage is one of Jesus' signs. And at first glance, it might not seem that important. It's right at the end of John's gospel. It's after Jesus has been crucified and is risen from the dead. He's already met his disciples twice since he's risen from the dead in a locked room in Jerusalem. So this is, some might say, an afterthought, a story that's sort of been tacked on to the end after the main event. John himself would disagree with that, I think. So if we look at what John says right before this account and right after, it's pretty clear that he thinks it's fairly important to include. He says in chapter 20, verse 30, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. So John's gospel doesn't have everything that Jesus did in it. And he later says in chapter 21, verse 25, Jesus did many other things as well, sort of reiterating that same point. If every one of them were written down, I suppose that even the whole world would not have room for the books that would be written. So what John is saying here, I've made this point in a sermon before, so I won't labour it, is that his gospel is the highlight reel of Jesus' life. This is a collection of the best bits. Basically, anything that wasn't important didn't make the cut. It's sort of like watching Match of the Day. You know, you get the best bits of all the football matches, but none of the rubbish, boring passing backwards and forwards in between. So this is what John's gospel is about. And that's especially relevant here because this passage is sandwiched in between those two quotes at the end of John's gospel. So we know that he really means it about this bit. This bit's really important and we should pay attention. So focusing in on tonight's passage, let's just remind ourselves of what actually happens. So setting the scene, John says, Jesus appears again to his disciples later. We're told that this is the third time that he's appeared. We knew he appeared twice before in Jerusalem. And he says a collection of the disciples and Jesus' followers. We've got Peter, Thomas. So this is the same guy doubting Thomas who wouldn't believe that Jesus was really risen from the dead until he touched his wounds. We've got Nathanael from Cana in Galilee. We've got the sons of Zebedee. And here's John. He's referring to himself here, James and John. Are the sons of Zebedee, but he's being very modest and just saying the sons of Zebedee. And then there are two others as well who aren't named, so seven in total. And they're all together in Galilee. So they've left Jerusalem after Jesus has been crucified and is risen again. Even though they've met him there after he died, and they've gone back to Galilee, and they've gone back to their old lives as fishermen for some reason. We know that in verse 2. So that's the kind of background. Peter says, I'm going to go fishing. And they all decide to go with him. And they all get together into one boat. And they fish all night. They don't catch anything. Early in the morning, Jesus appears on the shore, but they don't recognize him immediately. That's not really unusual if you consider the fact that we later learn that they're about 100 meters away from the shore. So, you know, even though they've been spending the last year or so with Jesus, following him around, it's so far away that they can't tell it's him when he first calls out to them. And he asks them if they've caught anything. They say, no, we haven't. He tells them to cast their net out on the right side of the boat. They do, and they're actually unable to haul all the fish into the boat because the catch is so heavy. And in doing this, in sort of bringing this miracle to be, Jesus is proving that he's not only alive, that his power has not been diminished at all by the fact that he's been killed and has risen again. So he really has truly defeated death. He's in some ways more powerful than he was before, in that he's no longer limited in the ways that other people are. The disciple whom Jesus loved, again, this is John talking about himself in a very modest way, recognizes that the person who's shouting to them from the shore is Jesus. And he says, it's the Lord. He knows it's Jesus. He realizes suddenly who it is. And when Peter hears this, he just can't wait for the boat to go to the shore. He can't; it won't go quick enough. So he just grabs his coat and jumps in, starts swimming. 100 meters. I don't know about you. I used to do county level swimming, so that doesn't seem too scary for me, but 100 meters fully clothed, that's a long way in open water as well. He's almost risking his life to jump out the boat and go to the shore so he can beat the boat back and get to Jesus as quick as he can. And the other disciples, they follow in the boat. They're towing this net behind them. And when they get there, they find that Jesus has sort of set up a little barbecue for them. There's bread, there's a fire going. I don't know if you missed this when you read this through, but there are already fish on the fire. If you've got your Bible out in front of you, have another look at that. So they've just caught this massive load of fish, 153 in a net, and Jesus has already got some on the barbecue. This is over-catering to the extreme. This is Jesus just being ridiculously generous and overabundant. And then Peter brings some of the fish that they've caught and puts them on the fire. They all share the fish and the bread, but none of them dare ask Jesus who he is. They already know. They know it's him. There's no doubt in their mind at all. So this is quite a dense passage. I'm not going to try and cover everything there is to know about the passage at all, but I just picked out three things that I thought were really important, and I just wanted to share them with you tonight. And I've broken them down into 3 points, so we'll cover them one at a time. The first one, believe and trust in Jesus, and we can expect his abundant blessing. So, fish and fishing is a common theme running through the Gospels. Indeed, fish, a symbol of a fish, was the first symbol used by early Christians to sort of secretly identify each other. And, you know, we can see this on cars nowadays. Some people have a little fish on the back of their car, a little silver fish. And what that stands for is, so the phrase, let me get this right, Jesus Christ, Son of God, Saviour, in Greek, when you take the first letter of that, of each of those words, and put it together, it spells ichthys, which is the Greek word for fish. So that's where that comes from. But fish is a sort of a common theme running through all of the Gospels, and is used very frequently to symbolise God's abundant blessing. So when we think of fish, one of the first things that comes to our minds is the feeding of the 5,000 very often. And that's in all of the gospel accounts. This is, you know, well known, where Jesus takes 5 loaves and 2 fish, breaks them down, hands them out, and somehow miraculously multiplies the food so that it feeds 5,000 people. And then there's, in Matthew and Mark's gospels, there's the feeding of the 4,000, which is actually a separate account where Jesus breaks down 7 loaves, and suddenly all these thousands of fish come pouring out, and they share out the fish with 4,000 people. So, on a very basic level, fish symbolise God's abundant blessing. And it is God's blessing, because without God, there's nowhere near enough food for the 5,000 or the 4,000. We're talking about, you know, maybe a meal for 2 or 3 people here. It's only with God, and the disciples bring these things to Jesus, that and because Jesus is God, he has the power to multiply that and feed all of the people. And he doesn't just feed them so there's just enough. There's a complete oversupply. You know, baskets and baskets of crumbs and scraps are filled up afterwards. This is just, you know, absolutely crazy amounts of food. And that's what's happening here in our passage as well. So, on their own, Peter and the others in the boat are trying desperately to catch fish all night, and they go the whole night without catching anything. Soon as Jesus turns up, tells them what to do, they literally can't grab the net out of the water and empty it onto the boat. There are so many fish. And this whole idea sort of recalls Jesus' own words. If we look at Matthew chapter 19, verse 26, Jesus says, with man this is impossible, but with God all things are possible. And what Jesus is saying here is we should believe and trust in God. And then there will be a whole world of opportunities opened up to us. And sometimes this is against what we think is our better judgment as well. So I bet when Jesus asked Peter and the others to cast their net on the other side of the boat, they probably thought, who is this guy? You know, we're fishermen. We've been fishing for years. We know what we're doing. This is our home turf. the Sea of Galilee. This is where we grew up. This is where we fished all our lives. We've just been fishing all night. And you've turned up, and the first thing you've said is, why don't you throw the nets over the other side of the boat? They were probably thinking, what on earth are you talking about? You don't know anything. But they do it, maybe out of curiosity, because they don't know this is Jesus at the moment. But they do it, and against their better judgment, God blesses them abundantly. And so I think what John is saying here, and one of the lessons we can take away from this, is that sometimes when God tells us to do something and we can't make sense of it, and it just goes against everything that we think is logical and right, we're wrong. He's got a plan. It's a good plan for us. And he wants us to just go for it and to ignore all of our kind of concerns and our sort of neuroses and our worries about that, and just go headlong for it. Just like Peter diving out of that boat, heading for the shore. Ignore all of that. Go for it. If God is telling us to do something, sometimes we just need to shut up, listen, and do it. And if we do that, we can expect to be blessed richly, as Peter and the other guys in the boat were. Point number two, remember why you put your faith in Jesus in the first place. So, I've kind of alluded to it already tonight, saying that this is the kind of second miraculous catch, but you might be thinking, as we've been reading through and going through, I've heard this somewhere before, this sounds really familiar. What's going on? This isn't the first time I've heard about Jesus and guys fishing and not being able to get everything in the boats. And that's because this has happened before. If we look at Luke's gospel, Luke chapter 5, 1 to 11, almost exactly the same thing happened. So in this situation, you've got Peter, you've got James and John, who are all there the second time round. And basically what happens is Jesus is preaching on the shore of Lake Galilee. He sees Peter, James and John, who he hasn't really met yet at this point, and they're sat there with their fishing boats. And Jesus decides the best way he's going to be able to preach to a big group of people is to jump in a boat and go away from the shore a little bit so everybody can see and hear him. So he calls Peter over and he jumps in his boat and they go out. And after he's done preaching, they then go out into the Sea of Galilee a little bit further, and he tells him to cast his net over. And again, loads of fish, can't pull it onto the boat himself. He calls James and John over, and they have to come and help him out. And eventually, they get to the shore, and they've got huge amounts of fish again, and they don't know what to do with them. But crucially, Jesus then calls Peter, James, and John to follow him. So he tells them that he's going to make them fish for people from now on, or be fishers of men. So they do that. They drop everything then and follow him. So this is sort of, this passage tonight is evoking that first passage. We know that Luke's is a separate event. It's not just a duplication in John's gospel, because when Luke talks about it, he's talking about Jesus doing one of his first miracles before he's crucified. In John, this is one of his last after he's crucified and has risen again. And in Luke's account, Peter, James and John haven't yet met Jesus, and this is their first encounter with him. This is how they're first called. In John's, it's almost their last contact with him. In Luke's account, Jesus is on the boat, and in John's, he's on the shore, which is maybe symbolic of something. It might be that represents the separation between them when Jesus was in the grave, or maybe the separation when he's about to go into heaven bodily. He's going to be separated from them physically. But why is Jesus doing this? Why is Jesus doing this in John's account? He's sort of recreating a moment from their past. is almost an exact carbon copy of something that's already happened to them. If Jesus is God, why is he repeating history? Why is he making this happen again? Well, I think basically he's trying to give them a bit of a kick up the backside, give them a bit of a wake-up call. After Jesus was killed, we know from John's gospel that they're a bit of a loss as to what to do, and they're kind of hiding out in their upper room in Jerusalem with the door locked. So Jesus appears to them there to try and get them to get going, to answer his call to become fishers of men. But instead, what they've done is they've run away. They've gone back to Galilee, back to their day jobs, effectively. Jesus is basically trying to remind them of that first encounter with him, and remind them what it felt like, how they were amazed at this man who could work miracles, and also remind them of what he asked them to do. And I think sometimes we can be a bit like that. We can get into a rut where we've sort of forgotten what it first felt like when we came to know Jesus, and how amazing that felt, and how it's just completely transforming, and it gives us a sense of purpose and direction in our lives, and we fall back into our old habits that we had before we came to know Jesus. We lose direction, we forget why we chose to follow him in the first place. And this is really what's happened to Peter and the guys in the boat. Jesus is saying, remember what it felt like. And this obviously works with Peter, because instantly he jumps out of the boat and straight away he's in the water and he's off swimming for the shore, 100-meter sprint. I think sometimes we need to be more like Peter. So forget about those kind of distractions and the things that pull us away from Jesus, and just go for it headlong. And my last point tonight, spread the good news about Jesus and trust in God to do the rest. So I just want to pick up on a phrase that Jesus used in Luke's account that I've just mentioned. So this is the first miraculous catch. He used the phrase fishers of men. He was going to turn Peter, James, and John into fishers of men. And this is fishing as a metaphor for spreading the good news, the gospel, and encouraging people who don't know Jesus to turn to Christ. And part of the reason this works so well as a metaphor is, just like fishermen, and that they can't guarantee that they're going to catch anything when they throw their nets into the water, we as Christians cannot guarantee that the gospel message is going to result in somebody turning to Christ. We can't guarantee it's going to land with them, especially not by our own efforts, our own power. Just like the fishermen, when they cast their net, when we spread the good news about Jesus, we have to trust that God is going to do his bit as well. God will bless us with a catch. That's what we're hoping for. And actually, that should be liberating to us. It's not all down to us. It's not all down to our own efforts. All we have to do is follow what God tells us to do, just like Peter and the disciples did, whether to cast our net out on the left side or the right. And we've just got to do that and trust that God will do the rest. So in conclusion then, this passage isn't just an afterthought or last minute addition tacked onto the end of John's gospel. This is Jesus coming back from the dead, performing an amazing miracle to remind his disciples of how they felt when they first encountered him, and to spur them on into action as well, to get them out of that rut. It shows us that if we put our faith in Jesus, we can expect abundant blessings that without him simply would not be possible. It encourages us to remember how it felt when we first decided to follow Jesus and what he calls us to do. And it also, lastly, gives us confidence to spread the good news about Jesus, knowing that it's not all down to us. All we have to do is cast out our net, and we trust in him to do the rest.